Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Helen Crane. And coming up, the rise of the unretirement. How money woes are forcing early retirees back into the jobs market. We take a look at the FTSE 100's winners and losers of 2022. It was electric heaters last week. Now we turn our attention to log burners and ask if they're really cheaper to run than central heating and in-demand drives. Simon will reveal the used cars that have risen most in value over the last year. Does yours feature in the list? Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, the cost of living crisis is forcing many older Brits who left the job market since 2020 back into the workplace. Fresh data from the ONS reveals money is the key motivation for almost two-thirds of post-COVID job leavers aged 50 to 65 who are considering coming back. It means the total number of people classed as economically inactive as well is starting to fall. Before we dig into this, Simon, just give us a bit of an explainer, if you would. What does economically inactive mean?
If you're economically inactive, it means that you are a person who is neither working nor looking for work. So you've just fallen out of the work arena altogether. And these people have been something of a puzzle since the COVID pandemic struck. The UK has seen a sharp rise in economically inactive people. Many of them are, we're talking about people here who aren't claiming benefits. They're not claiming, you know, job seekers allowance or whatever you call it nowadays. Instead, they appear to be just relying on their own finances. And the idea is that there's a number of reasons for this. For example, the number of people who are out of work owing to a long-term illness is at a record high. The ONS has put some figures out on this recently, and there was an inquiry by a House of Lords committee that was released this week into the 565,000 workers who've left the jobs market since the start of the pandemic. It said that early retirement among those aged between 50 and 64 was the main driver of the trend. The question is, why have all these people taken early retirement? What lies behind this? Because this is at complete odds with the narrative that we've been hearing of people are choosing to work for longer, people are working for longer, work is more flexible, and so on.
And you can work from home as well. That was during the pandemic. So why would people leave? It would seem more convenient, no?
Well, I guess, and this is where the sort of drilling down into it has come from, is trying to uncover what's going on here. And it does look as if it is people across the employment spectrum. So, for example, white collar workers who could benefit from working at home and the increased flexibility that that has brought, and actually the increased flexibility in terms of the idea that this could increase productivity because it would enable you to more easily hire people who can do some work when it suits them and suits you, without having to employ them 5 days a week to come into an office. There's a huge productivity gain to be had from tapping into the expertise of people who maybe only want to do a couple of days work a week, and they don't want to be coming into the office. And in fact, they live in a completely different place. We've got a real productivity problem in this country, and that's where the real gain in productivity potentially comes from the whole working from home revolution, not from Jacob Rees-Mogg going around and sticking notes on people's desks asking why they're not there. That said, there are some jobs that you obviously can't do from home. And there is a bit of a divide in this country, certainly between the stereotypical, you know, working from home and refusing to go into the office end of the spectrum, and the, well, I've had to be going into my place of work and help and serving you guys every single day of the pandemic end of the spectrum. But there are people missing from those jobs too. And some of this people think is due to ill health, but not necessarily the kind of ill health that then involves people actually claiming sickness benefits, but the kind of ill health that has just made people decide that they don't want to work. There is a long COVID issue as well, potentially going on here. People just don't feel able to work, there's concerns over mental health as well off the back of the pandemic. You know, the lockdowns were terrible for people's mental health. But there's also just an element where there's a thought that people have just decided, well, you know, I've reassessed my priorities. I think I can probably get by without working, and I've decided I don't want to work for the time being. One of the factors that has come into play in the House of Lords inquiry into why the UK has a higher level of this than almost any other major economy, especially European ones, is the fact that people can access their pensions from the age of 55. We have a lot of personal pension savings in this country in terms of like employment schemes, like defined contribution schemes, and also you know, even with some defined benefit schemes, you can take that pension at a lower rate potentially from the age of 55, and also from personal pensions that people have invested into. In a lot of European countries, your work pension is bundled together in a way with the state pension, what we call the state pension. They don't have those two separate systems that we have. And that means that for many people in places like France, for example, you've got to keep working through to a certain age, because otherwise it really messes with the amount that you're going to get with your pension. Versus the UK, you've got your pension pot. Okay, yes, you're not paying any more into it, but it's not reliant in the same way. You've got your pension pot, you've done your 35 years of national insurance, that's it, you're sorted. You know, you're missing out on some money you could pay into your pension, but you're not going to miss out on your state pension. Whereas with some of the European systems, it's more tied together, which is why actually when we look at figures on how generous the UK pension is compared to other countries' state pensions, they're a bit skewed and they're not entirely accurate. They're not telling people exactly what they think it's telling them, because more of our work pensions are tied into work stuff, whereas more of the European ones are bundled together. That said, the UK state pension is not the most generous in the world. But anyway, the big conundrum is where have all these people gone? But it now looks like some of them might be coming back.
I'm wondering, Helen, if we know this, I doubt we do, it's ONS figures, but are they slipping back into their old jobs? Are they having to find new jobs? Where are they going? Do we know? What do you make of these figures as well?
Sure, you're right. We don't really know where they're going. But I think Simon's right in that, you know, people might be looking for more flexible work, especially following COVID. Like you said, people might be able to work from home. And I think as well, I mean, this is just anecdotal from people that I know, but people are looking for jobs that fit around their other commitments, I think. So all of my parents and step-parents are in that sort of 50, 64 age group that are the ones kind of returning to work. None of them have retired, but a lot of them in their sort of later years of work have slipped down into kind of part-time jobs or just jobs that are a bit less kind of stressful. So my dad, for example, he worked most of his career as a sales director for a big company. A few years ago, he decided to become painter and decorator. So he's his own boss. He only works a couple of days a week. You know, he's still working. He still kind of needs the money, but it's nothing like kind of what he used to do. And I think people might be looking for things like that. You know, people are paying off their mortgage for longer. People know that the cost of living is high and is probably going to stay high for the next few years. So I think people who might have retired and now thinking, you know, if I'm still fit to work, I can just work for a couple more years and kind of shore myself up for the years to come. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a rise in kind of older people doing part-time work and things like that.
Simon, broadening this out to the UK economy generally, the Bank of England must be quite pleased about this, surely, because in their last interest rate rise decision, and Andrew Bailey, the governor, came out afterwards and talked about the tight labour market. You know, we have as many people looking for work as we do job vacancies. So if more people come into the market, that must be a good thing, no? Well, for the Bank of England's perspective.
Yes, it should be a good thing. And from the Bank of England's perspective, because actually one of the things that this House of Lords report said is that this early retirement trend is driving inflation and harming growth. One of the issues with inflation is the cost of people's staff is being passed on to customers in terms of higher prices. you get, you know, that's where the fear of the wage price spiral comes from. But not that we're really seeing one of those, I don't think. But yeah, if you can get more people back into the workforce, then you should be able to improve growth because you can improve productivity, and you should be able to take some of that inflation out of the picture. And it's hard to untangle that from the idea that we think being paid more money is a good thing, and arguably being paid more money is definitely a good thing. But there is if you think about it in aggregate, everybody being paid more money and then the companies that are paying those people more money then charging you more as a consumer, which causes inflation, which means that you then think, hang on a minute, I'm going to need some more money, is a bad thing. So it's a difficult one to get your head around, let's say. But yeah, if we could get more of these people back into the workforce, then that would be considered a good thing. Now, I think there's a couple of things here that are important to think about. One, as you said, and Helen just said now, are those people going back into the workforce doing the same job? The greatest boost to productivity really probably comes from people with years of expertise going in and using that expertise in the same job. But likewise, a total change in career or a change in job or bringing your expertise to bear on another area also has the ability to substantially boost productivity. Because you know what? There's a possibility that somebody who worked as a sales director for many years and then decided to become a painter and decorator might be more enthused by the prospect of being a painter and decorator than somebody who has spent their entire working career as a painter and decorator. Now, I don't know, I'm not going to cast any aspersions. They might not be quite as good at it because they don't have all those years of expertise. But you know what? They might work that a little bit harder, that a little bit faster. And you know what? Somebody who's spent their entire life as a painter and decorator, maybe they'd make a really good sales director because they'd be really keen on it as well. And they wouldn't be so fed up of it that they're thinking of going and getting a job as a painter and decorator. So I think a little bit of moving around could maybe do us some good. Then you have to look at the fact that I guess a lot of these people, especially if we're talking the early retirement scenario, don't want to be working full time. So how do we accommodate that? Companies, I think, still shy away from part time a lot. But maybe companies and organizations need to be thinking a bit more flexibly in order to think, right, how do the workforce has substantially changed its mind due to a hopefully once in a lifetime event that has dramatically altered people's perceptions, because it's the only time in my lifetime it's been illegal to leave the house. So people's outlooks have changed, and how do we capitalize on this? And is there a way to capitalize on this? So maybe, you know, a degree of flexibility. And then also I think there's maybe another element play here where if it is people have taken a degree of early retirement because of the pandemic, it changed their priorities and all those other things, maybe a year without COVID bothering them, I guess, a year and a half out of work, they've decided that actually their priorities have changed, but not so much that they don't want to work anymore ever again, and actually they'd quite like to do something. And so I think there's maybe just an element there where some of those people are drifting back to the workforce because, well, you know what, they've had a break. I mean, who wouldn't like a year off?
Yeah, that's true. It's true, Helen. I mean, it sounds easy, doesn't it? You think, well, I quite fancy, I don't know, being a plumber, for example. I always say to myself, what am I going to be when I grow up? But it's not presumably they're going to be that easy. So do you have any tips for returning after a break? Obviously, I'm picking the youngest person here to do this. But generally, I mean, what are the implications if you've started taking a pension, those sorts of things? Like, what do you need to be thinking about if you're going back into the workplace, if perhaps you want to retrain, you want to do something different, etc.?
So finance-wise, there are quite a few things that you need to think about. You're right, it does hinge quite a lot on whether or not you've started claiming a state or a private pension yet. So if you start a new job, if you're above state pension age, you won't be automatically enrolled in the same way that you would be if you were under state pension age, but you do still have the option of joining your new employer's pension. So it's something that's worth thinking about. On the other side of the coin, you might want to stop claiming your state pension for a while if you do go back into work. That's because it will boost your state pension for when you do finally retire. So you stop claiming it, it gives the pot more of a chance to build up. You know, if you can get by on the income that you're earning for your new job, even if it is only part-time, stop claiming your pension, and that will put you in a better position for when you do retire. And private pensions as well, so it works in a similar way. You know, if you pause that, then it gives your pension more time to grow. So yeah, it's financially, it can be very much worth doing if you are able to go back into work in later life. Worth kind of looking at perhaps the tax implications as well of going back into work. But we've actually, I think we're going to have an article going up on This Is Money in the next few days on that. So do look out. That's going to have a lot of tips and tricks for people who are joining the great unretirement, as they're calling it.
I'm the daughter of a man at 72 who's still working. So this is odd for me. But good luck if you are going back into the workplace. May you be whatever you want to be.
My mum is 73, I think. And she still runs her own business.
Fab.
And she spends 4 days a week looking after her grandchildren. Not mine. My brother and sisters, mine are old enough and they're now at school.
She's a hero.
Literally don't know how she does it. Years she's been saying she's going to sell the business and stop running the business, but she's still running the business and do 4 days a week of childcare.
Which is amazing, but that leads on to another, which we haven't touched on, is what will happen to all those grandparents who've been caring for grandchildren. I mean, that will have surely a knock on the parents, no?
Yeah, that's a huge thing, actually, right? Because childcare in this country is so extortionately expensive. Compared to the cost of childcare in other European nations, it is out of the park expensive. And in fact, nursery fees are in many cases more expensive than private school fees. So yeah, you can see why there are so many grandparents looking after their grandchildren. Mm. So yeah, I guess maybe there would be a productivity impact of them all suddenly rushing back to work, but I don't think that's going to happen. They're not all choosing not to work, and they're not all going to suddenly rush back. We're talking about a chunk of people in a specific kind of age bracket.
All right, then let's move on. For many investors, 2022 will be a year to forget. Popular stocks plummeted in the face of higher inflation, rising interest rates, and the threat of recession. The FTSE 100 managed to hold up in the face of global volatility compared to other markets. So let us take a look at how the FTSE 100 has done this year and which companies in the face of serious headwinds have come out top and bottom. But Simon, what's the year been like for investors?
That is a question that very much depends what you are investing in. If you've only invested in the FTSE 100, and to be clear, if you've only invested in the FTSE 100, you're sort of doing it wrong. You're not very diversified, and you are putting all of your eggs into a basket, albeit a basket that holds 100 eggs. But yeah, it is more risky than just investing across the global market. If you're invested in the FTSE 100, at the point when we are recording this now, you are up 0.28% on the start of the year. Okay, doesn't sound amazing, and in fact, it's one of the first years in a while you've had more money if you put your cash in a savings account. But then when you compare that to the S&P 500, the major US market, you'd be down 19% if you were invested in the S&P 500. And if you look at the Dow Jones industrial average, for example, you're looking at a similar fall. What's interesting about the UK market, though, that's incorrect. If you're looking at the Dow Jones, you're down 9%. Okay. What's interesting about the UK, though, is, of course, the FTSE 100 only represents the top 100 biggest companies, and they are heavily skewed towards large multinational corporations. And it's been kept afloat by some of the companies that have done well this year, which we'll talk about in a minute, but we're talking like big energy companies, oil, gas, that kind of thing. If you look at the FTSE 250, which is considered to be more representative of the UK economy, a lot more domestic focused businesses in there, bad news, you're down 21% year to date.
Helen, for those people who are not experts and that have been looking at their pensions and investments through the year and somewhat feeling depressed about it, what's the advice?
So I think the thing that's always said with investing is that, you know, it's something to do for a kind of long-term horizon. So the money you put into investments is supposed to stay there for at least 5 years. That's to give you a chance to kind of ride the market ups and downs. So I think generally the advice is things are probably going to balance themselves out over that kind of period of time. So if you need to access the money soon, that is a bit of a worry. Try not to do that if at all possible. Try to generally, I think I'm right in saying this, I mean, the advice is to kind of ride it out where possible. Don't take your money out now if you can, because you'll kind of crystallize the losses.
But Simon, we asked this question when we did a pension special with Sir Steve Webb, and I think it's relevant to ask it again, is people will be looking at, for example, their pensions. And if you are in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, you've got time to ride it out. But we are in the middle of a cost of living crisis. There are lots of pressures, and you'll be looking at things like your pension thinking, hang on a minute, I've stuffed in, I don't know, let's say 5,000 or whatever this year, and it's gone backwards. Have I wasted that money? Should I lower my contributions? Don't take the money out. Obviously, that would be a stupid thing to do. But what should I be doing? Is it wasted money? Have I just thrown away these grand down the toilet?
No, because if you look at the statistics that go back 100 odd years, you will find that over the long term, investing pays off. It has been proven to be the best way to make a real return on your money, i.e. one that is above inflation. And the long term average return, we're talking like 5-6% basically. And that's real returns. Okay. So, but within any period that you pick from those 100 plus years of stock market statistics, you're going to find some years where people ended up down by quite a bit. The worst thing you can possibly do is try to time the market, because even the professionals find that notoriously difficult and will warn people not to try to do it. And you can do it sometimes and feel like you've done an amazing job. There are people who invested in April 2020 as everything was crashing all around them, and they were brave and they were bold and they put loads of money into the stock market and it went up loads and loads and loads, and they did really, really well. But there's also every chance that you could have thought that and then the market went down, and some of those people have now since lost money on some of the shares that were spectacular winners, have turned into spectacular losers. It's very difficult to try to time this kind of thing. And if you are a long-term investor, then what you need to do is just keep investing over the years and rely on the fact that companies' ability to use money for profitable means will endure, because otherwise they'd just put the money in the bank and they wouldn't bother with the whole rigmarole of being a company and running a company. And if you are investing broadly, for example, across a stock market, if you have a tracker fund, the simplest way of investing is in a tracker fund. It tracks the FTSE 100, tracks the S&P 500. Ideally, you want the broadest possible one that tracks the global stock market, something like the MSCI Global Index, right? Now, that will spread your money across lots and lots and lots of different companies. And the thing is, you'll be investing in the winners, because the losers fall out of the index and the winners from the couple of rungs down come up into the index. So you're always investing into the companies that are doing well. Within that basket, there'll be some that do well and there'll be some that do badly, just as there were in the FTSE 100 this year. But the idea is you invest for the long term, and also never underestimate the power of reinvested dividends over the long term. In fact, those are actually the major component of average long-term stock market returns. And just to put this in context, over the past year, FTSE 100 is flat, pretty much. The winners, BAE Systems, defense giant, winner for an obvious reason, war, up 50.9%. Pearson, education giant, has been sort of used to do textbooks, things like that, used to own the FT and the Economist, has since been pivoting towards trying to, you know, the digitalization of education and so on. Its shares have been in the doldrums for years and it's been really suffering. But this year, up 49.4%. Glencore, commodities giant, up 42.9%. And then you've got the oil majors, BP up 42.3%, Shell up 41.4%. They're making super profits at the moment. They did make super losses within the pandemic as well. So, you know, the pendulum swings. But then amongst the losers, top loser, a pandemic winner, Ocado, down 60%. Then we've got another company that had been a major share price winner in recent years, Persimmon, house builder, down 56%. Mm-hmm. Who knows whether those shares are going to bounce back up again? You know, whatever happens with the housing market, we need to build more homes. And the people building homes in this country are the major house builders. Dekra, chemicals giant, down 47%. ICG, down 45%. And then another house builder, Barratt Homes, down 45%.
So this is the thing I want to ask you, Simon. Is there a theme? Like, you can look at the oil giants and you can look at the weapons manufacturers and those, and you can see why there's a theme going on here. Is there a theme going on with the losers, or is this something structural to those companies, fundamentals of those companies?
Well, the theme going on with some of the, if you divide it up as broad as possible, the theme going on at the moment is that people are looking for companies that are making money now rather than promising to make money in the future. This is what this shift to value investing over growth investing is. Things are more uncertain. Interest rates have risen. So you can just put your money in the bank for a year and you can now get 4%, basically. So you need a much higher hurdle rate in terms of expected profits to justify investing the money and taking some risk. So therefore, people are more likely to look at companies that are making money right now rather than companies that are promising to make money in the future. You've then got a scenario where there's a lot of companies that are promising to make money in the future who are either not making a lot of profits or taking their profits and reinvesting them into other endeavors. And investors are a little bit less convinced about some of these things. Ocado was a massive pandemic winner. It is, you know, positions itself as a tech company, not as a grocer. And it's involved in these amazing, you know, robotized warehouses, rolling this out to other partners around the world and everything like that. But the shares were, you know, priced for perfection. The house builders are still making money hand over fist, but interest rates are going up. Mortgages are more expensive. House prices, there's concerns they're going to fall. Are the house builders going to continue to make money hand over fist? I mean, who knows? But even when they were making money hand over fist, their shares were actually quite lowly valued on a price to earnings ratio, and they pay quite big dividends. So there's lots of people out there going, well, I still think the house builders are a good investment.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, a broad brush approach is that people are much keener on stuff that doesn't look too expensive, that's making money now and is paying a dividend, rather than shares that are promising jam tomorrow.
Before we move on from this one, Simon, what should investors do in volatile times? Is your research slightly different? What are you looking for? I understand that, you know, investing is for the long term, et cetera, diversify. But is there anything extra that as we move into 2023, people should be or could be looking at? The diamonds in the rough, as it were? Where is our focus?
I think people have to be very careful about trying to be too clever. And I think they need to look at things very carefully before they buy them. This is especially true if you are opting for active investing, and especially true if you are picking individual shares. Now, let's take the example of Cineworld, for example. Let's say that you decided that as the economy reopened and the COVID restrictions ebbed away, people were going to go to the cinema. Right. And where are they going to go? Well, they've got Cineworld, major player. Okay. And you're like, right, I'm going to invest in Cineworld because I think it can do well. Top Gun 2 is coming out. People are definitely going to want to watch that one. You'd be down 88% this year. Now, that's not a problem necessarily if you hold Cineworld as part of a portfolio of 20 different shares. And you've got 20 different shares that are sort of exposed to different parts of the economy and do different things. it is probably a problem if you hold Cineworld as part of a portfolio of only 5 shares. And it's almost certainly a problem if you only hold Cineworld shares, if you bet the house on Cineworld. So that's a really great example of why you need to be diversified. And I would argue that the place that people should start is a broad, cheap, global tracker fund, rely on the ability of the world's biggest companies to make money. And then if you want to try and invest in some stuff that you think is going to outperform, invest smaller amounts into those. This idea of like a core part of your portfolio and a satellite part of your portfolio, because it's amazing how things can go against you. I mean, this time last year, everyone was working on the basis that Marks and Spencer, for example, had finally managed to turn the corner. It had finally got its act together, and this was it. M&S was going to do really well. There are actually quite a lot of people who still think that. And I would argue that M&S has probably finally got its act together. The shares are down 48% this year.
That's it for part one.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.
Before central heating, fire was the main way to keep our homes warm. As radiators were rolled out widely during the 1960s and 70s, though, many fireplaces and stoves in older homes were removed or fell into disrepair. But now all the evidence suggests that households worried about soaring energy bills are turning back to wood-burning stoves in order to save money. Is it a good idea, though? Helen, the rise of the wood burners. Is it good for your wallet? It's bad for the environment, I imagine.
So this is a story that's really sort of caught the eye of our readers, which is understandable. You know, energy bills are going up hugely, as we talk about all the time. To have a look at the numbers on this, so the last time the government took stock of how many people were using wood burners or burning wood to help keep warm in any way, this was back in 2015, and they found that only 7.5% of the UK population was doing that. They don't take these stats very often, so we don't know, but the anecdotal evidence suggests that wood burners are massively on the rise. We spoke to a clean fuel organisation called HETAS, and they've said that the people who install and clean wood burners are working absolutely flat out to meet demand. So loads of people want to get a wood burner in their home. It seems like a good idea. Logs are obviously quite cheap, free if you happen to live near somewhere where you can get free logs. Is it going to save you money on your energy bills, though? As with a lot of the tips that we suggest on bills, it really depends. It depends on how you use it, and it depends crucially on whether you already have a wood burner. So if you don't already have one installed, the cost of installing one are really, really high. So buying a wood burner could cost anything from about £400 to £2,000. On top of that, you've got labour and installation costs, which would be £2,000 upwards. So this is several thousand pounds to get your wood burner, which is probably going to wipe out any savings on your bills, unfortunately. If you do already have one, great time to start using it more. Logs are the cheapest domestic heating fuel after kerosene. This is according to Bruce Allen from HETAS. They cost homeowners 10.37 pence per kilowatt hour versus 12.81p per hour for mains gas and 39.2p per kilowatt hour for electricity. So yes, logs, very cheap, but not if you don't already have a log burner.
But Simon, not great for the environment. Imagine, is it Michael Gove won't like this?
That depends, actually, very much on the logs. You need to, if you get a new wood burner, then it has to meet certain environmental standards. And it also depends on the wood that you burn. So you can't burn green wood. It has to be properly dried wood. And don't burn scrap wood either with, you know, bits of paint and stuff on it. That is bad for the environment. And there have been concerns about air quality, certainly in towns and cities, because, you know, people getting log burners, obviously this year it's very popular, and actually it's astonishingly for the first time in a while, it's cheaper as a source of heating than using your central heating. That is if you buy the logs in bulk from somewhere that sells them to you for a cheaper price. It is not cheaper than your central heating if you're buying plastic bags of logs from the petrol station. That is one of the most expensive ways to do it. But you will get a nice fire for the evening, which is partially, I think, what lies behind a lot of this, rather than necessarily energy efficiency. So it's not necessarily bad for the environment, but it's also not necessarily good for the environment. The thing is, as Helen said, this does rely on you already being equipped in terms of having a log burner, etc., if you want to do this as a money-saving thing. But I think a lot of people don't do this as a money-saving thing. They do it as a nice-to-have thing. And the fact that potentially, if they're just sat in their living room where the fire is of an evening and they burn some logs and they get lovely and toasty and warm, and it means they don't have to put the central heating on as well, that's a major benefit. But I am, for the first time in my life, the owner of a chimney.
Yeah, okay.
And I have been the owner of a chimney for the past 2.5 years.
How's that working out for you? Enjoying that?
My chimney, unfortunately, has no log burner.
Mm.
My chimney has a condemned gas fire sitting there. The gas has been capped off. Don't worry, I'm not using a condemned gas fire. The plumber that we know who came and checked out the gas and everything before we moved in said, yeah, I've condemned the gas fire. He's like, what I say to people is like, if you want to use it, it's your own risk. I was like, right, so I could still use it. He's like, no, because it's yours. I've capped it and unplugged it. I was like, okay, thanks. But he didn't remove the gas fire. So it's still sitting there, unused, you know, in the like one of them little metal baskets with the fake coals on the top kind of thing. Every so often I look at that and I think, I really need to get that out of that empty fireplace. No, what I think is I'd love to replace that with a log burner, but you're talking 1500 quid minimum. I've got to pay for the log burner. That chimney has almost certainly not had anyone having a fire in it for many, many years. So I'd have to get the chimney sorted. It probably needs relining. That's the expensive thing. I reckon minimum outlay 1500 quid. I mean, because like at a basic level, anything you ever do in your house costs you 800 quid for a start, right? So then you've got to add another 700 quid on top of that, I'm thinking, probably more. I reckon I'd think 1500 quid, I'd end up £2,000 out of pocket by the end of it. That is not going to save me money on my heating, is it?
Also,
that's absolutely not going to save me money on my heating. Having said that, I was at a friend's house on Saturday night. She does have a log burner. I was very jealous. It was still freezing cold on Saturday night. I was really worried her house was going to be cold. So worried, I did the most middle-aged thing ever. I took my slippers to a party.
Oh, you didn't, Simon. I thought you said you were going to wear a thermal vest or something, but this takes it to another level.
No, I was exiting the house. Marvellous. And I went to change from my slippers into my shoes. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to take these off when I get to Jess's house. I was like, yeah, I'm taking my slippers with me. They're not really slippers. They are actually a pair of espadrilles, an old pair of espadrilles. And then do you know what I did on the way home? I left them in the taxi. My espadrilles in an Uber.
What a nice gift. A little Christmas gift there.
I know. I said to her the next morning when my wife was talking to her, I said, can you ask her if I've left my slippers at her house? She said, no, I haven't seen them. I was like, damn, I've left them in the Uber. Anyway, the point of this ridiculously long story that's made me sound like a right mug is that she had a log burner. Her house was toasty because we spent all the evening in the small room that has the log burner in it. And in fact, it was roasting hot in there. So it could work, but she's already got a log burner. We were in the same room all evening and it was relatively small.
Well, that's the thing. There's no thermostat on that, is there, Helen? Just one quick question on this. Only because I remember when I was little, we had a chimney in one of our rooms and it was absolutely freezing because there's a big hole to the outside, isn't there? I mean, the insulation isn't great, is it?
No, exactly. That's another thing. If you're in the type of house that has a fireplace, it's likely to be an older house and probably a house that leaks a lot of energy. I'm going back to my mom's house in a couple of days for Christmas, and she lives in a Victorian house, lovely fireplace in the winter. You know, obviously she doesn't use it very much now because of it's extremely bad for the environment, but you know, we do have it on a bit over Christmas. But yeah, absolutely right. Most of the time her house is absolutely freezing because, you know, it's still got some single glazed windows. Mm. It, you know, extremely drafty. I get freezing. I will definitely be taking all my warm gear. I'll be taking my slippers to my mum's house 100% because it is freezing. I mean, it's probably about 100 miles north of where I live in London, so I feel the cold a bit there anyway. I'm a very cold person, but yeah, it's going to be cold.
All right, then, finally, let's move on from this. Used car prices remain at record levels despite the impact of the cost of living crisis. Now, a combination of short supply of new models and encyclopedia-long dealer order books are pushing car buyers to the second-hand market. Some vehicles are in such high demand that their average price is now over a third higher than it was this time last year. So what are these cars? Simon, what's been happening to the used car market? And what cars are doing well, which are not?
It's still been going up. If you look at it over the course of the whole of the last year, the price of used cars. If you look at it more recently, we've started to see some falls. And we talked about this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. So regular listeners will be thinking, hang on a minute, they told me they were coming down the other day. But over the course of the past year, they are still up. And if you look at the used cars that have risen in value the most, it is a real ragtag bunch. It always used to be that what would happen with used cars is the only used cars that went up in value were exceptionally rare ones and special ones, or ones that had reached the bottom of their depreciation curve, i.e. they were so old and so cheap that they couldn't really get any cheaper, and they then started to get more expensive as people decided that even that Ford Fiesta from 1989 was now a classic car, or classic cars themselves. But instead, we have the Mercedes V-Class, which is its sort of van-type MPV, you know, 7 or 8 seater van, up 36% used prices, followed by the Citroen C0, which is a teeny tiny Citroen hatchback, up 28.9%. Toyota Prius, speaking of Ubers, up 26.2%. Some of them come with free slippers. Dacia Logan, up 22.2%. And then we get to the Mercedes G-Class, which is a whacking great 4x4 Tonka truck of a car that costs an absolute fortune and is up 21.3%. Then we go back down the scale to the Volkswagen E-Up. No, not Volkswagen's Yorkshire car, but its electric version of the Up, up 19.8%. The Renault Zoe, Renault's little electric car, up 16.8%. And then Nissan's Mad Wagon GTR, up 16.2%, followed by a granny shopping car, the Hyundai i10. Apologies to all listeners who have Hyundai i10s and are not grannies going shopping. That's up 15.8%. And then another little Citroen, the Citroen C1, up 14.2%. As I said, a real ragtag bunch. Question is this going to continue into next year? I don't think so. I think dealers are starting to get much better stock of new cars in. That's going to take the edge off used car prices as people are more able to get their hands on new cars. And I think that we maybe have started to see the end of the used car boom. And maybe the canary in the coal mine for that is I think maybe car hire prices might be edging down a bit as well, because car hire companies are managing to get their hands on some cars.
All right, then, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the reader comments. And Merry Christmas.
Yes, indeed. On behalf of all of us here on the pod who've appeared throughout this year, a Merry Christmas. Don't worry, we'll have one next week as well, looking back over 2022. What a year that's been. You don't want to miss it. well, 2022 you might have done. But either way, Merry Christmas to you all. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.